Hello? Well, hi, how are you today? Well, I'm fine. Who am I speaking with? Well, this is Samantha down at the bank, Chase Bank, and I just wanted to let you know I have some good news for you today. Oh, yeah? Good news? You like good news, right? Yes, I normally do. Usually I do. What is your good news? Well, it's the new year, and every year at the end of the year, beginning of the new year, we have to do an audit at the bank, and of course we have to assess our unclaimed funds. We have to disperse with these unclaimed funds by April the 15th, tax time, you know. And as it would happen, it looks like you may be in line to receive some of our unclaimed funds. Wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't you be able to use a little bit of extra cash this time of year, free? Well, yes, I would, but how much? Well, it could be up to $10,000. Wow, that sure would be helpful. But how do I get this money? Well, all we need is your email, your full name and address, and of course we have your phone number, but we also need your social security number. If you would give me those, we will go ahead and get started. Get started they will. They certainly will. Obviously you recognize that as a scam. There are many, many scams going around now, and they're all evil. They're all evil. Scams are sort of the evil 101, or the introduction to evil in one sense. We know, probably most of us know some people who may have been scammed in one form or another. Everything from we talked about the churches being broken in is not exactly a scam, but it's another form of evil, and there are many different types of evil going around in this world. The first documented scam is listed in a book I have. It's on page 4 of a book I have. And this scam artist was very slick. Really, he was more devious than any of the other scam artists that were out there. And, of course, he tried to prey on the weak and unsuspecting. You probably have the same book, if you would. It's recorded in Genesis, the 3rd chapter, of course, starting in verse 1. Said he was more cunning, and he was more devious, he was more subtle or shrewd or crafty than all the other life forms or all the rest of the life on earth at that point, at that time. And he came up to the woman, and he started making his pitch for the scam. He said, "Has God really told you?" Now he posed it as a question, you know, as if he really wanted to know, which he didn't, of course. But he says, "God really said that you can't eat of all the fruit in the orchard here? Why, look at all this beautiful fruit. Look at all this abundance and plenty. Has God said you can't eat of every one of these trees? And, of course, the woman said, "We may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden. We may eat, but there is one in the middle of the garden that we're not allowed to eat from because this particular tree is off limits. We can't eat from it, and we can't touch it. We're not allowed to touch it because if we do, we're going to die. We're going to die." God had said, if you touch it, you will die. The serpent said to the woman, "You will not die. What are you talking about? You're not going to die. For God knows that in the day you eat, that your eyes will be opened. You'll be just like God himself. You'll understand what's good and what's evil. You'll be able to determine for yourself all the good and all the evil in the world or the things to come." Well, the woman looked, and sure enough, this tree looked very tantalizing, looked very appetizing, and looked like it would be good to eat. I've had fruit trees. I think I had six at one time, and I think I have two of them left because I, a little bit like the fig tree that Christ said to, why cumbers it the ground, because it just wasn't producing. But there was one tree amongst these six trees that I have that always had, it was a peach tree, and it always had great big sumptuous looking peaches, somewhere between baseball and softball size, and they always looked so good. But every year when I went to get one, some of the peaches, and I bit into them or cut into them, they were rotten in the middle. Now, I will have to admit that some of that was my own fault in that I didn't do a lot of the things that you need to do to really, for an orchard or a tree with fruit, to actually produce good fruit. But my thinking went like this. If I want fruit that's been poisoned and sprayed and so forth, I can go down to the local market and buy it. Why do I want to do that to my own fruit? And I never quite figured out how to get around that, to actually get good fruit without putting, spraying poison and so forth on it. There are oils you spray on them and different things, blossom rot and different types of things that you're supposed to spray on them to get them to produce better fruit. But I know what good fruit looks like, and it doesn't mean that it always is good. Eve here and her husband Adam were being introduced to good and evil. Mostly evil, because they saw that the tree looked good, very pleasing to the eye, very good, looked very good for food, and they decided to go ahead and try it and see if what this snake, this serpent, was telling them was true. They were willing to take that chance, and of course they were introduced to a world of evil. And evil has been with us ever since. Now I want to look at a couple of examples of evil and the spread of sin and evil. Sin and evil are almost synonymous terms. Sin is what basically causes evil. It's the root of evil. So I want to look at a couple of examples of evil and to see how it impacts and affects us and how it spreads. I'd like for us to come away with two helpful ideas in our confrontation with evil as we come into contact with evil. The title of my message is Arresting Evil. And I'm doing this, wanted to get into this because we're on sort of the descent into the Passover and Holy Day season. And in the Passover and Holy Day season, we always begin to examine our life and to see what we could improve, what we need to eliminate, and so on. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to address the subject of evil today. Genesis 6, and in the fifth verse, from Adam and Eve to Noah was 10 generations. By the time they got to that 10th generation, the world had become so evil that God basically had to reset it, or it probably would have almost extinguished itself a long time prematurely. So from there on, to from Adam and Eve on, this evil that had been introduced into their life and into the world just continued to go downhill. It continued to get worse. It continued to be more intense and worse and worse and worse. In verse 5, Genesis 6, by that time, when Noah was alive, said, the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time, continually. It was just evil. That's all there was, pretty much. There were a few people that were not evil. Only a few, though. After the flood, though, and they started over with Adam and Mrs. Adam, and Shem, Ham, and Japheth and their wives, only eight people, they started afresh. And there were only whatever animals had been able to be preserved and saved on the ark to repopulate the earth with animals and so on and so forth, as well as people. But again, and we heard a little bit about this in the sermonette, things went downhill, and another 10 generations from Noah to Abraham, we have the incident that was described in Babylon. Babylon was another evil society. People had congregated together. Seems where the biggest congregation of people are, the big cities, is where evil and sin is the worst. It just seems that seems like a fact of life almost. Because when you get into most inner, a lot of the big cities in the inner cities, they're pretty bad. They're pretty bad. They're trying to clean some of them up and with mixed results, but that seems to be the case. Seems when people, the more concentration of people, the worse things become. Matthew 24 says that as it was in the days of Noah, so it will also be at the end. So it's not really going to get better or getting better. Some people speculate, for example, Methuselah lived to be 969 years old, the oldest documented or recorded human being. Some people feel that maybe the reason God shortened the lifespan of people was so that people would not have as much time, individuals would not have as much time to live and generate, perpetuate evil. Can you imagine if Hitler, for example, would have lived to be 900 to 1,000 years old? It would have been absolutely horrendous. And that's why I'm not saying it is. There's speculation to that point. And I want to also make sure that I'm not conveying the fact or the impression that everything is evil and there's nothing good. We read stories about good all the time, or quite often people running into burning buildings and so on and so forth to save other people, and people taking care of people anonymously in a lot of cases that have needs and those type of things. There are good people also. In fact, it's probably, to some extent, like it was for Elijah. Elijah thought he was the only good person left. But God, when he was doing his woe is me thing to God, which we do too, God told him that I have 7,000 people reserved to myself who have not bowed the knees to Baal. There's a lot more people than Elijah thought there were. And it's probably that way with us too. There are people we don't know of and so forth, and there are good societies. But it seems where the influence of decent people is the strongest, that's where the most good is done. So where good is prevalent, it's perpetuated. I think, I forget where it was, one of Paul's writings says that evil corrupts good manners. So association with evil tends to lead downhill, because as Matthew 24 says, more and more the love of many, because of lawlessness and evil, the love of many will wax colder and colder. It'll go weaker and weaker. Here is a fact of life. You can jot it down if you want. Evil comes naturally. Good has to be worked at. Evil comes naturally, but good has to be worked at. It doesn't necessarily come naturally. Human nature comes naturally. One of the greatest forms, and we're going to get into this just a little bit, of evil is war. And whether it's a small war or a large war, if you will, doesn't really matter. It destroys and kills. War is one of the worst forms of evil because so many things happen. If we look at the Second World War, there's a folk song that was written. It wasn't written during that time. It was written in the 70s. It was called The Green Fields of France, alternatively called sometimes No Man's Land. And it was written by a Scottish singer, folk singer, writer named Eric Boyle. Eric Bogle, B-O-G-L-E. And it's called The Green Fields of France. And what they were doing, the hymn portrays a couple or some people walking through the green fields of France. And they came to a cemetery, probably with a lot of those little white crosses in it. That was a World War I cemetery. You can look it up on YouTube if you want. You can find the song there. But they sat down. They were walking. It seemed like there might have been a couple or something like that. They got tired. They came to the cemetery. They sat down in the green field here in the grass next to one of the graves, the grave of Willie McBride. And it says, and it sort of encapsulates a little what war does. Though you died in 1916, in some loyal heart, you're forever 19. Because that person that dies in war, or anywhere else for that matter, is never going to get older than that. And he goes on to say, man's blind indifference to his fellow man. A whole generation was killed and was damned. This was the First World War, which was fought to end all wars. That's what they hoped or believed. Now, he concludes by saying, did you believe when they told you the cause? Did you believe that this was the war that would end wars? It wasn't. It never did. There has never been a war, yet to end wars. But there will be a war to end all wars at some point. And it's coming, and it won't be denied. In 1861, a great evil swept across this country, our country. And it didn't end for 4 years. It went on for 4 years till 1865. It was the Civil War. Many of us have maybe gone to some of the Civil War battlefields, Antietam, Gettysburg, and so forth. I've only been to the one at Gettysburg. I've taken the tour several times, and I always think how disastrous it was, because there was ended up being a lot of hand-to-hand combat, which is one of the worst forms of war there could be. I was on a bus one day with one of my sons, and there were little Round Top and several of the different places there at Gettysburg that you can tour, and there was a fellow sitting next to me, and we got up onto one of the areas, and there was a thicket. It had a name, and I never could remember what the name was. It was Pickett's Thicket or some such name. And he said, the fellow sitting next to me said, my great-great-grandfather lost his leg here at Pickett's Thicket, or whatever the name of the thicket was again. But it happened. There were 7,000 people between July 1st and July the 3rd in 1863. There were 7,000 people that lost their life in Gettysburg. And Gettysburg is a small town. It's about the size of, we live close to Louisville, Ohio. It's about the size of a Louisville. It's not very big. But 7,000 people lost their life. But this is not really the war that I want to talk about. About the middle of the Civil War, another skirmish, or another war, you could call it a war, broke out in this country. It was on the border of West Virginia and Kentucky. The Big Sandy, the Tug Fork of the Big Sandy River divided Kentucky, Pike County, Kentucky, with Logan County, West Virginia, which later became, was split in two and became Logan and Mingo County. And this was between two Appalachian families. It was the most famous feud in the history of the United States of America. It was between the Hatfields and the McCoys. I don't know if ever studied into the Hatfields and McCoys. You've probably seen some of the movies, or there was even, I think there was a series, wasn't it? A comedy series, probably, I think, between the Hatfields and McCoys, maybe similar to Mayberry or Andy Griffin or something like that. But it's been quite a while. But this particular feud reached all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States of America. The Hatfields lived in West Virginia, and they were led by William Anderson Hatfield, or William Anse, they called him, I think. I think that's how it's pronounced. It's A-N-S-E. Devil Anse is how they call him, and whether you got that name because he was particularly evil or vicious or whatever, I don't know. The McCoys were led by Randolph or Rennell McCoy, and they lived on the other side in Pike County, Kentucky. And again, it was on the Big Sandy River, and they were on the Tug Fork part of it. Now, that was, both of those places were below the Mason and Dixon line, which means they were Confederates, generally speaking. Not everybody probably was, but most people down there were. Each one of these tribes or families or groups had a lot of kinfolk and a lot of allies in their community. It was like rural communities were, and this was pretty remote, and they had a lot of people on their side, which the roots went pretty far out, and they were pretty well allied, so to speak, with a lot of other people. They were both proud Appalachian families. They were both very prideful and very, I've seen families who were maybe like that, where there was a code that the family lived by, and if you didn't live by that code, you were pretty much ostracized or fellowship from that particular family. They were like that. They both held strong beliefs, and nothing went by the wayside. Everything had to be accounted for. Everything that happened had to have an opposite result. That was the Hatfields and the McCoys. The first major bloodshed, or the first bloodshed period, happened sometime in 1882. Now this, it began and escalated from about the middle of the Civil War, which was between 1861 and 1865, so it could have happened 1862, 1863, and so forth. Somewhere in that is when the feud started. Nobody's quite exactly sure. But in that major first bloodshed, what happened, they were at a county fair or a reunion of some gathering of some kind, and a brawl broke out between the Hatfields and the McCoys, or the McCoys and the Hatfields, depending on which way you want to look at it. And Ellison Hatfield, who was, I think he was a son of Devil Anse, he was shot and killed. And that was the first killing or bloodshed there was. But this really intensified the feud. Now, it was on because they all felt like now this has to be retaliated for. There were relatives and marriages intermingled with both of them, and the feud escalated. The Hatfields kidnapped three of the McCoys and executed them, three brothers of the McCoys and executed them. But there was repeated ambush killings of each back and forth between them. Both sides were repeatedly arrested, and they were either acquitted or released because they would, if, for example, the Hatfields came into Pike County, Kentucky, and they did an atrocity of some kind. They ambushed somebody or hurt somebody or did something, kidnapped somebody. They had to be arrested back in Mingo County, West Virginia. Well, when they did, all of their cronies were on that side of the river, so nothing happened. They'd be released or they'd be acquitted on some false trumped-up charges or whatever. Happened from both sides. So nothing really ever took place or happened. Nothing ever caused it to de-escalate or to stand down. The feud climaxed on New Year's Day of 1888. It climaxed on that day, on the evening before, New Year's Eve, excuse me, a bunch of the Hatfields got together for their New Year's Eve party, and of course it was a drunken, debaucherous event. So they, the McCoys is who this was. So they decided that evening that what they were going to do was they were going to advance. I had it right the first time, by the way. It was the Hatfields. They were going to advance, and they were going to finally and for all time end the feud. Their plan was to head over, cross the river into Kentucky, and they were going to execute and kill all the McCoys, and that would end the feud. That would end the feud. Well, they attacked the home of Rennell McCoy. He escaped, but his son and daughter were killed. And all it did was actually make it worse to some extent. In retaliation, a posse of the McCoys and their neighbors took off. They were led by Pike County Deputy Sheriff to go across and to get the Hatfields. They were going to get them and bring them back. Well, they did. Jim Vance was the leader, the deputy sheriff was the leader of this group. They got nine people. They rounded up nine people and brought them back for indictment and trial in Kentucky. They got nine Hatfields, the McCoys did, and got them back to Kentucky, and they were going to have a trial. Well, West Virginia wouldn't have this. They filed a lawsuit in federal court charging kidnapping and lawlessness, and that particular lawsuit made it all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States of America. And by this time, it was gaining a lot of notoriety. People from all over the country, newspapers were, they still had newspapers in those days. They don't like very much anymore. But the newspapers were all sending reporters, and the reporters would send stories back home, and the story really got blown up because now the whole country was following the feud. The trial resulted in nine sentences of imprisonment and one sentence of death by hanging, which did occur. Flare-ups continued, but they gradually, from that point, started to die down and to stand down a little bit. And it made me think of a passage in Ecclesiastes, the 8th chapter. Ecclesiastes 8, it was something that Solomon wrote. It says in verse 11, because the sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the hearts of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. Because it's not done in a timely fashion, because it's not done right now, because it's not done speedily against an evil work, therefore it just continues and it grows. If the Hatfields and McCoys, if something had been done instead of just catch and release with whenever something happened, this particular tragedy could have been lessened by a great deal. It would have been shortened, or it could have been shortened. And it was a very, very destructive to that area feud that took place. James, the 4th chapter. In James 4, James always goes right to the heart of things, and he did in James 4 as well. He gives the foundation or the reason for fighting and battling and war in James 4 from in verse 1. He asks the question, where do battles or wars and fights come from among you? Don't they come from your desires for pleasure that war in your members? You lust and don't have. You murder and covet and cannot obtain. You fight in war, yet you do not have. It's a human nature issue, is what fighting is all about. And James, as I said, goes right to the heart of that. In verse 16 of the previous chapter, he said, for where envy, verse 16 of chapter 3 of James, where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. Where self-seeking and envy, and self-seeking or selfishness, narcissism and so forth, where those things are, that's where confusion and every evil thing starts. Jesus Christ said in Matthew 5, 21 and 22, we don't necessarily go there, but he mentioned that anger and hatred is the root of murder. It's the root of that violence. It's where it begins. It begins in the mind. And when people don't control that, then it gets out of hand, like the feud did with the Hatfields and McCoys. It continues to grow, hate and anger and animosity, and then pretty soon actions take place, and you have circumstances that perpetuated things like the Hatfields and McCoys. Genesis, the fourth chapter, going all the way back to the beginning. The first few verses, the early verses of chapter 4 of Genesis, are some of the most important verses in the Bible because they point out some things. They tell us some things that we might not otherwise have known. It's the incident between Cain and Abel. Cain and Abel was basically the first war. It was a mini war. It was just between two individuals, although it affected, obviously, more than two individuals. God got involved, and obviously it would have affected Adam and Eve as well. Whether Cain didn't know what killing was or what the result of it was, could be possibly brought into question, but he must have, because there must have been laws, as we'll see here in just a minute. But this, again, was the first mini war. It was the first murder that took place. As Adam knew Eve, his wife, in verse 1, and she conceived and bore Cain, which I think means a choir. She got a man child, and said, I have acquired a man from the Lord. She bore again, and this time his brother, Abel. Now, Abel was a keeper of sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. So Abel was a herdsman, or he had flocks and herds, and Cain, he was a tiller of the ground. He was into agriculture rather than animals. He was a husbandman of the ground, so to speak, of the soil. In the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Lord. Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat. Now, for this to have taken place, they didn't really dream this up necessarily on their own. There had to be a system that they were aware of. God must have explained what he expected, or they probably would not have done this. Otherwise, how would they have known to do sacrifices to God? Obviously, they did to some extent. The Lord respected Abel and his offering. And it's often speculated that about why that he respected Abel, and in verse 5, he did not respect Cain and his offering. The what Abel did, he brought of the very best, the fat, the firstling, the firstborn, of the best of his flocks. He brought the right offering to God. He brought the firstborn, the first fruit of his offering, where maybe Cain might have been more lax. Cain may not have paid much attention. Oh, here's some onions or whatever, and I'll bring those and put them all on the altar and so forth. Just whatever happened to come to hand. That's sort of what the indication would be here, or sort of what it almost seems like might have happened. It never anywhere exactly says what took place. But as we think about it, in deductive reasoning and logic would say that something like that took place. But again, God did not, in verse 5, respect the offering of Cain. And Cain, it made Cain very angry, and his countenance fell. It's probably that same way still today. Instead of people being, sometimes, some people, being spurred on to greater achievement because they see what somebody else did and say, hey, we could achieve that too. Instead of that, they allow envy, greed, jealousy, rage, anger, get in the way, and they follow that route instead. Instead of letting these things motivate them, when they see somebody that was superior, instead of allowing that to motivate them, a lot of people, especially in today's age, just get envious of what other people have accomplished and get mad. And then they take appropriate action. Sometimes they try to steal and rob people and so forth and so on. Or maybe they'll figure out other ways, have the government take it from the wealthy and give it to the not so well off, and which is great if that's necessary. But sometimes people just don't want to do anything to help themselves. They just want other people's stuff, and then they figure out a way to take it. That's what's cropping up here a little bit. And God asked him, why are you downcast? Why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? Verse 7 is one of the critical verses in the Bible. If you do well, will you not be accepted? If you do not do well, sin lies at the door. And the word there, and its desire is for you, is the following statement. It's proposed in a way that it's like it's crouching at the door and waiting for you to open the door and spring in and grab you, just like Satan did with Eve. Get in there, get her confused, and cause her to do the wrong thing. If you do not do well, sin lies at the door, and its desire is for you. Excuse me. The rest of the verse, by the way. But you should rule over it. The King James says, I think you shalt rule over it. The regular King James. I'm using the New King James. And each one has a little different twist to it. The Living Bible says, you can conquer it. There's another translation that I want to bring to our attention. The JPS translation, it's the Jewish Publication Society. It says, its urge is towards you, yet you can be its master. What we're seeing here, even the way it's translated here, is that we have free choice. We have the choice to do right or do wrong. We can do right or we can do wrong. Many of you know or have heard of Dennis Prager. Dennis Prager is a Jewish scholar and a student that teaches the Torah, or the first five books of the Bible, teaches about that. And he wrote a commentary on the book of on the first five books of the Bible. And specifically here, he wrote one on Genesis. And here's what he has to say, which I thought was pretty interesting, and that was about yet you can be its master. He says, yet you can be its master is one of the Torah's most important statements. It means, which it does in every one of the translations, it means that we have the free moral will and that we can do what's right or that we can do wrong. That we can rule over our desire to do wrong is the most empowering idea in life. When we think about it and we approach things with the idea that yes, we can do what's right, we can reject what's wrong, we can reject evil, and we can embrace good. When we come to a problem with that idea, it empowers us to do what's right. He goes on, the only way that we can end bad behavior, actions that are either destructive to others or to ourselves, is to first recognize that we can be its master. If we regard ourselves as incapable of controlling ourselves, example, when I get angry, I just can't control my temper. If we tell ourselves that, well, it's not my fault, I can't overcome this, this is not possible for me to do, if we tell ourselves that, then chances are we're not going to be able to do that. If we tell ourselves that, we never will. One might say self-control is the most important achievement that we can attain, and I would venture to say that if we had perfect self-control, which I stand before you here to tell you that I do not, I'm still working at that, I am still trying to achieve a greater level of self-control, and I'm pretty weak, so I have a lot of things I can work on coming or heading towards Passover in the days of unleavened bread. There are plenty of things for me to look at in my life and say I can do better. But self-control is one of the virtues that Peter talked about in 2 Peter. We can quickly go over there. 2 Peter 1, from 5 to 8, there are some virtues listed there. 2 Peter 1, 5 to 8. Well, let's back up to maybe verse 4, by which we have been given, which have been given to us exceedingly great and precious promises, that through these we may be partakers of the divine nature, having escaped the corruption that is in the world through lust. Again, that's 2 Peter 1 and verse 5. But also for this very reason, giving all diligence, now here it says, some of the steps we're to take. Add to your faith virtue. To virtue, knowledge. To knowledge, self-control. And to self-control, perseverance, and so on. There are 8 different things mentioned here, all the way up to brotherly kindness, love. Good has to be developed. Good has to be worked at. Evil comes naturally. We don't have to work very hard at evil. We just can naturally gravitate in that direction. He goes on to say here, Dennis Prager, in this commentary on this verse, after he says, one might say self-control is the most important achievement we can attain, he says that many parents work harder to instill self-esteem than self-control in their children is a moral tragedy. And ironically, no self-esteem can equal the self-esteem that derives from self-control. And I would say that is so. He cites them. I've never seen this movie or read the book. Maybe, I think there's a movie. The book, East of Eden by John Steinbeck. And he talks about a Chinese person, Chinese American, who came across this in the King James Bible, and he wanted to know. And I'm talking, when I'm saying he came across this, I'm talking about Genesis 4 in verse 7. And he was curious about that, and he hired some rabbis, and he learned all about the Hebrew language, and he came to the conclusion that we can, that we have the power, that we can overcome. Now, I want to preface that we can reject, rather, evil and do good. I want to preface that by saying it's a lot easier said than done. It's that way with everything. But God did not give us or impose on us laws and things that we cannot accomplish. What God gave us, we can do. That we don't is the different stages of self-control. If we, again, had perfect self-control, we could pretty much keep everything. But we don't. But what God has given us is His Spirit. And that His Spirit, that particular subject, is for a later date, possibly more towards the day of Pentecost. We can look into that a little bit more. But we do have additional power that not everybody had. Probably Cain didn't have, because the Spirit of God's Spirit was not necessarily extant to a very great degree at that time. But what do these stories, what do they have to do with us in our encounters with arresting evil, or our encounters with evil in particular? Things like the evil that comes from telemarketing or scams that are perpetrated on people that are unsuspecting and don't expect to be taken advantage of. The Hatfields and McCoys, how does that fit into this, into the evil? Adam and Eve, and even Cain and Abel's story, what did those have to do with our individual, our encounters with evil? Well, the Hatfields and McCoys, there were continued skirmishes on down the road and on down the line, and they continued to have some battles, even probably, maybe even into the early 1900s. They had battles and so on. It isn't even clear when it started. Nobody knows for sure. Some think that it's a continuation, or was a continuation, or things that happened during the Civil War. Maybe it was. I think one or two of the Hatfields may have joined the Union Army, and that may have possibly escalated things. It's possible. There is a lot of information about the Hatfields and McCoys, but it's hard to find anyone that agrees with everyone. So it's hard to find out exactly what happened. There were documentaries done and dramas, I guess they call them, done about the Hatfields and McCoys, but none of them quite matched up with the next one coming along, and so on and so forth. It's probably just one of those convoluted things that we'll never know for sure. Some think that it was over a stolen pig. Maybe it was. Again, they were a very prideful bunch of people. Anything that happened, they would not leave it alone. They would not say, well, okay, it's not that big a deal. That wasn't their M.O. That wasn't their modus operandi. They would try to take control of anything that came along. They would try to retaliate for almost anything that happened. Some think, and it may have been this too, that it was over a forbidden romance between one of the Hatfields and one of the McCoys. I forget which one it was, but one of them, I'm almost thinking it was a McCoy, that was having an affair with Hatfield, and the result was a child out of wedlock, and Hatfield refused to marry the person, and so on and so forth. And people think that maybe that was the reason, or that was the cause for these people to start this feud, which lasted for years and years. And animosities went much further down the road, and hatred than actually activity and action went. Even as I mentioned, maybe into the 1900s, the early 1900s. What is clear is that 13 people lost their lives in this feud. 13 people. Many more were injured, maimed, and so forth, maybe for life, crippled for life, and so on, as well as countless other lives were affected by this. Finally, in 2003, Ron and Bo McCoy, who were two cousins, got together with Rio Hatfield. Now, this is since 2000. This was in 2003. Got together with Rio Hatfield. All three of them were direct descendants of the Hatfields and McCoys, and they signed a treaty officially ending the Hatfield and McCoy feud. It dragged on. Well, I'm sure it didn't drag on that long, but it still had ramifications all the way down to the 21st century to some extent. We can look around, scams, evil. It's a way and a fact of life in today's life. As I said, not everything and everything is evil. There's also good. But evil affects us in a worse type of way than good does. It causes more issues for us. When Samantha from the bank called the person that she did and told her, hey, I need your information so we can give you, she was offering the forbidden fruit, so to speak. When she called the lady, if the person had made the decision, click, to hang up on her, that would have been the end of it. That would have been the end of it, and evil would never have gotten started in that case. It would have ended it. The Hatfields and McCoys could have done what Bo and Ron McCoy did with Rio Hatfield and decided to get together and say, you know what, we forgive you, will you forgive us, let's end this feud. They could have done that at any time. The best time would have been before it ever got started. Once something like this, once evil gets started, it is so much more difficult for it to stop, for it to end. Because it's out of the box, the genie's out of the box. You can't, if you tell a lie to somebody, you no longer have the control to stop that lie. You no longer have control of the other person not telling that same lie to somebody else. And that person telling it to somebody else, and so on and so on and so on, till it explodes and it never can be put back in the box. But if you never do it, if you resist the temptation, then it can be stopped before it ever starts. Eve could have said that slickster, the serpent, Satan, the devil, who said, I'm not interested, get away from here, and that would have been the end of that. Now, I don't know how that would have come out in the long run, but nonetheless, it would have stopped it at that point. If Cain had decided not to give in to the sin crouching at his door, that evil that he did to Abel would never have happened. It would never have gotten started. It would never have grown in his mind and into an offense that had to be executed for. It never would have gotten that far if he had decided not to give in at that point to the sin that was going, the evil that took place. Who knows how that would have changed history? He might have, Abel never had a history. He never had anybody down the line that were his children or his offspring or his descendants, because he was executed and killed before he could get that far. Here are the two things that I want us to keep in mind, the two ideas that I want to keep us to keep in mind when we're confronted with evil, when we're confronted with sin, and with a decision about whether we're going to sin or not. When it comes to evil or sin, we can be its master. It's not easy. It never is, but we can ask God to strengthen us, to help us through His Spirit and so forth. But we can we can be its master. We don't have to give in to it. God never gave us things that were too hard for us. He never gave us things that we can't accomplish. Now, because we're human beings, we are weak, we have human nature and so on. We will give in to things, but it's not one individual thing. If we took the Ten Commandments and we said, let's look at thou shalt not kill. Well, I doubt that any of us in here has ever killed a human being. Maybe in a war or something it could have happened, but of our own volition, I doubt that that ever happened. It's not a commandment that we cannot do. Thou shalt not bear false witness is not a commandment that we can't do. Maybe it's difficult and maybe we're tempted to do it, but we need to be, as I think Proverbs says, we'll swear to our own hurt. Even if it hurts us, we will tell the truth. We can do that. There, we can go right down the list, honoring our father and our mother, adultery or coveting or any of the other, thou shalt have no other gods before me, all those things. We can do them. It's difficult, but we can do them. God did not give us things that we can't do, that we can't handle. He said he would not test us beyond what we're capable of. The second thing is, we can stop it before it gets started. We can stop these things, evil, sin, whatever, before it gets started, because once it's started, it's very difficult to end. Now, we can't stop war because we don't have that power at this point. We hope to at some point. But we can't do it now. We can't stop war. And we only have limited ability to affect our surroundings. We can affect our surroundings, but we can't totally affect our surroundings. Things happen around us that we have no control over. We can't do that. But we can affect ourselves. We can learn self-control. As I confessed a little earlier, I'm not there yet, but I'm working on it. We can arrest sin and evil in our own life. And obviously, we never want to minimize the power of God's Spirit working in our life to help us arrest evil for ourselves. We, as God told Cain, can be its master. We're empowered. God empowered us to do that. And as we begin to look forward to the spring holidays, to Passover, and we begin the examination of our own selves and see what we need to adjust, what we need to eliminate, what we need to do to eradicate or eliminate more sin from our life, to begin to refine our character. As we do that, we can look at these things and we can keep these couple of things in mind, that when it comes to evil, we can be its master and we can stop things before they start, before they get a foothold in our life. If we, just as an example, if we are tempted or if we have, we're standing there and somebody offers us a cigarette, here, take this pack of cigarette, I'm giving it to you. If we say no and never start it, we never have to eliminate it from our life because we already have made the decision, we're not going to do that. But if we do it and sort of let it get a little toehold and then a foothold, you know, the camel's nose under the tent, pretty soon the whole camel, cigarettes, I guess, will be in the tent. But if we don't ever start it, we don't have to eliminate it. We can do that. We have that power to do. When I look at one final scripture as we close, and that's in 2 Corinthians the 10th chapter, 2 Corinthians, the 10th chapter. You might remember that this particular, the 10th chapter of 2nd, or I'm sorry, I'm going to the first Corinthians. No wonder it didn't look right. But here, it's talking about, we'll start in verse 4. Says the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God, for the pulling down, or for pulling down strongholds. That's if Christ's Spirit is with us. Casting down arguments, verse 5. And every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God. And the rest of this verse is what I want to focus on and for us to think about. Bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. That is the self-control that we want to be working on. Lining all our thoughts up with Jesus Christ, having the mind of Jesus Christ, developing the character of Jesus Christ. And when we can do that, we can arrest sin and evil from our lives.